discussion that I wanted to carry on with other journalists. That discussion is going on now, and I'm really happy to see that that's happening. And I think that the sad thing has been learning from a lot of other journalists around the country that they're afraid to raise these questions, and in particular, journalists of color or transgender journalists who are in newsrooms that are mostly white, where decisions are, journalistic decisions are being made from sort of a certain perspective, and we're all aware that that perspective affects how we cover stories. We should cover them truthfully, we should cover them fairly, but I still think we should be questioning kind of the meaning of neutrality in this time, and a lot of people want to have that conversation, and they shouldn't have to be afraid to have it.
Well, we're going to continue the conversation after the show, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Our guest, Lewis Wallace, fired from the national radio outlet Marketplace on Monday after posting on his personal blog about journalistic neutrality and the challenges of being a transgender journalist in this era of alternative facts. That does it for our show. We'll also link to his piece. Very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Celebrating 100 Years of Recorded Jazz event on Thursday, February 16th at 8 p.m. at the Fremont Theater in Portland. On February 26, 1917, the original Dixieland Jazz Band recorded the first jazz record ever issued, which will be celebrated on February 16th by the Cherry Blossom Orchestra presenting a concert playing full tribute to the trailblazing original. They'll be showcasing many landmark recordings from the first 25 years of recorded jazz. Again, the Celebrating 100 Years of Recorded Jazz event on Thursday, February 16th at 8 p.m. at the Fremont Theater, 2393 Northeast Fremont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBU program is made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good
Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to KBOO, and thanks for tuning in to Positively Revolting Radio. I am going to be revolting for you today. Ani and Lynn have the day off, a little bit under the weather. I know Ani is, and send your best wishes to both of them. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, and I am going to be your guest host today. And today, our topic is going to be around the Muslim ban, as it's being called, that Trump initiated, and all the struggle that's gone on since, but not just in general. We're going to talk specifically about some cases as well. I have as a guest for you Attorney Tom Nelson. He is a longtime Oregon attorney. I would say a civil rights attorney in many ways, because I first remember hearing about him. I think it was the Kennewick man, the bones that were found of a very ancient skeleton in the Columbia, and he was defending and working with the Indian tribes around that issue. But for most of us, we would have heard of him, and we would have, because he has been in the paper, that he's been defending Muslims against the U.S. government, whether that's the U.S. government trying to put people on a no-fly list so they can't return to their own country and they're locked out of it, or whether it's people being abused by State Department people like Jonas Fikre, one of his clients. So he has a long record and a public record, and I encourage you to go to our website and look at the information that's there today under the name of this show, because there's some good background and a lot of Tom's own words there. So, of course, when I heard about this Muslim ban and the huge response by attorneys across the country to defend people being stopped at the airports, and then, of course, the large public outpour, I thought of Tom Nelson, and so I'm really glad to be able to bring him today here. Now, this is a talk show, and we want to hear from you. I'll let you write down the number now. I'm going to give it to you now. It's 503-231-8187. I'm not going to open the phone lines to come on the air until about 20 minutes after, because I want to have some time with Tom to get our conversation established and to understand what he's doing in the face of this Muslim ban. So you can call us, as I said, at 503-231-8187, but that'll be in a little while and I'll announce it. I believe we have Tom Nelson on the phone now. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Linda. Good to be here and good hearing you again.
Yes, it seems like it takes a crisis out there for you and I to get together, doesn't it?
That's right.
Appropriate as it should be, the press and the media. I mean, the press and the attorneys. Tom, I know, why don't you start with when you first heard about this ban and then how you've been propelled into particular legal action?
Well, it's really not much of a surprise that Mr. Trump is doing what he's doing. I mean, he was telegraphing it all through his campaign. I think he had to modify it a bit, saying things about Muslims in general. He had to focus it down, and he picked an area where the executive has pretty enormous power, and that deals with immigration. He selected the Muslim community from, I think, it's seven nations, including Iran and a number of others, Libya, and said uniformly, not on the basis of their religion, but rather on the basis of their nationality, that they will not be able to travel to the United States for a period, 90 days, and then after that we'll see what happens. Obviously, that ban cannot affect those who have American passports. My wife, for example, is Iranian-American and has an American and an Iranian passport. But it was such a sloppy, shoddy job of figuring out what you can do and what you can't, and it was sprung without any prior warning that people were caught flat-footed, particularly on the U.S. side. The Customs and Border Protection people really didn't have any advanced guidance on how to deal with this issue. As a result, people with, for example, green cards, permanent residents of the United States who had not yet attained citizenship, were in kind of a gray area. And the initial rule was that, well, if you have a green card and you cross the border coming back into the United States, we will, at that point, at that location review you and see if we like you or not. And if we don't like you, we will send you back to wherever you're coming from.
And this could be people who've lived here for 20 years, have a family and an established career. You know, I think what I was most heartened by was how rapidly people deployed to the airports. And I think that Trump unrolled this in the way he did, one, because he doesn't understand how bureaucracies really operate, and he doesn't understand that there are processes already in place. But two, to make it seem like an emergency, we had to, on an emergency basis, stop these dangerous people from coming to us. And I think the countries, just to get them out there for our audience, are Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. And so, in a way, I'm glad that he rolled it out as a big shock, because it also allowed all of those people who were shocked by it to come into action immediately.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And this is going to be an intensely political and even more intensely legal fight over the next several years. It is shocking what he did. You know, the problem with Trump is that he's what he looks like. He's a TV show host trying to run a country with no political background at all and very little understanding of the American political system, including things like checks and balances and constitutional guarantees.
He also shows no interest in really understanding those things. He just wants to sweep aside what he feels is in his way.
He's an entertainer, and he's entertaining.
A fascist entertainer.
The entertainment is at the cost of a number of people that are quite vulnerable already.
Well, Tom, you must have clients who will and have been affected by this. Did you have any of them that were detained at the airports or kept from flying back here from other countries?
No, most of that action occurred, you know, Portland really, for a number of reasons, doesn't have much of an international presence and has no direct routes to any of those countries. Most of the action has been back on the East Coast, of course, and I have been working with CARE, which is the Committee for American-Islamic Relations, and they have filed a lawsuit back in the Eastern District of Virginia. Matter of fact, the lead counsel in that case is also co-counsel in the Jonas Fichter case, by the name of Ghadir Abbas. So we are in communication. However, last night I was invited to speak at an Iranian gathering at a local restaurant down in southwest Portland. And there were probably 40 or 50 Iranians in the room. It was not a private affair, because other non-Iranians were also there, and they listened. As a matter of fact, one of the patrons of the restaurant, who's not Iranian, stopped the talk as I was giving it as she was leaving, and she apologized to the Iranians for the things that their country is doing to them.
Which is very nice, and I think we're seeing the public feeling the need to want to speak out against this.
See, yeah, you're seeing a lot of that. And you know, my wife, Iranian-American, wears a hijab. She's the only hijabi east of Gresham. And there have been several very, very kind comments from, she's a substitute teacher, some very kind comments from some of her fellow workers and folks like that when she goes out in the community. On the other hand, there is a core, a voraciously, almost rabid anti-Muslim core in the United States, and you know we saw it up in Ottawa City, which of course not the United States, where people really get it in their mind that regardless of you know what your personal history is, if you're Muslim, you're a target. That was the critical point I was trying to deliver to the Iranians last night at the restaurant, is because you are Iranian now, even Iranian-American, you are a target. And so we went through the drill that we always do with folks that are, for example, contacted by law enforcement. What do? And went a little bit deeper into how do you deal with immigration issues? What do you do at a border crossing with a U.S. passport? You know you're going to get back in, or worse yet, with a green card. You're not quite sure, but you probably will get back in. Or worse yet, with a visa, an F-1 visa, or something like a student visa.
What's an F-1 visa?
Basically, student visa. Visas that are any visa.
Like a work visa whatever, with a company, even like Intel.
Yeah, any visa below a green card. You're in real trouble. You probably won't get in. We've seen people, for example, we saw the Iraqi woman, the mother of a traveler who wasn't able to get back into the United States, wasn't able to board a plane, and had to stay in Iraq, notwithstanding a serious medical condition, and died in Iraq. That's just in the last 2 weeks. But basically, it isn't so much getting to the border. If you can't board a plane, you'll never get to the border. This is the old story of the no-fly list.
Mm-hmm.
The United States says, hey, you're welcome to come back to the United States, all you folks, but unfortunately, you're the no-fly list, and you can't fly. But you can try some other way. Our local judge, Anna Brown, put the kibosh on that, saying that international air flights are a constitutional right.
And she's a federal judge in the Ninth?
She's a federal judge right here in Portland.
Okay.
And let me say a nice thing about her. She's really quite a very, very good and careful federal judge.
Well, I think now one of the things is we've clearly seen people responding, and I don't really think that's going to ebb much. I think people are, it's a surprise to Trump how deeply offended people are by this kind of policy. And it's very heartening to me as an American to see how many people go out of their comfort zone. So many people who've not in or very rarely would do a protest rushing to the airports to support. And I believe that it's emblematic of a larger sense of feeling when you look at some of the, I was doing a little bit of research on this, and when you look at some of the videos that have gone viral, there's one of a Jewish man, and it's in the Chicago airport, and it's of a rabbi and an Islamic man standing side by side, and their two children looking at each other and speaking to each other. And the story is they just happened to be standing side by side when they went to the airport to try to do two different things. But the photo of them speaking so kindly to each other and so obviously went viral. And I think that says that's how so many of us want it to be.
Yes, it is really very, very heartening. And one of the messages I tried to give last night to the Iranian group, which of course predominantly she is that we as Muslims have to get over our sectarian divisions. You know, we have a common problem here, and we have to start dealing with it. And I'm seeing that too. The Muslim Educational Trust in Portland put on a presentation Wednesday night, and I wasn't able to attend because I live up where I do, but I understand over 1,000 people showed up to talk about the immediate problems facing the Muslim community. Not just Muslims were there, people of all faiths were there, but more importantly, it was a Sunni Shia gathering. You know, Mr. Trump is if you will, driving reconciliation, at least among American Muslims.
He's a big uniter, and he didn't even know it. United
sure
in opposition.
I bet he wishes he weren't, but he is. I mean, we do face a common enemy, and we have to be very candid that there is a real threat here. We talk about executive orders, which are below even regulations, and certainly below statutes, congressionally enacted measures. But it was an executive order signed by FDR that led to the internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II, which, by the way, in 1944, in the case of Korematsu versus United States, the Supreme Court of the United States upheld an executive order interning, imprisoning Japanese Americans who individually had done nothing wrong merely because of their ancestry. So the point that I'm trying to make here is there is a danger here. Now, at that time, of course, there was a much more united attitude, maybe not, but a much more united attitude among the American population that Japan was an existential threat to the United States. Today, and that was, I think, largely based on ignorance, because a number of Japanese Americans are valiantly and honorably in the armed forces against the Japan. Today, we have a Muslim population in America that is unlike in Europe, that is largely assimilated.
I think you and I talked once about a Pew study that was looking at American Muslims the most extensive Pew study ever done of American Muslims, and they're really sort of model American citizens. They move pretty rapidly to establishing themselves economically and educationally. They tend to dress like the rest of America and enjoy the same, you know, kinds of culture as the rest of America, and certainly seem to and want to assimilate, you know, more than other immigrant groups, as a matter of fact. People from Muslim countries tend to do a better job, and that's the one study that's actually been there. I wanted to ask you, Tom, though, you know, Sally Yates was the acting attorney general, and she, you know, had the courage. There's actually been a I don't know how you say it, a parody or something written in The New Yorker where she actually had the audacity to download a copy of the Constitution. But no, she didn't do that. But what she did do is know our Constitution, and she issued she refused to have the president's orders carried out.
Right.
And this is just one part of her statement. She goes, "At present, I am not convinced that defense of the executive order is consistent with our responsibilities, nor am I convinced that the executive order is lawful." And then she was, of course, immediately fired and a new one put in who would carry out his orders. To me, there's two things here. Is she right? Is it unlawful? Can it be fought on a legal basis? And I know what you're saying. Only if the courts have good judges, because that one got through. But also, it's a little chilling to realize he's just not going to put up with any disagreement.
Right.
So he's going to have only yes men and proponents of his ideas around him.
And fortunately, we do have the federal judiciary, and I think pretty uniformly, well, the decisions that have come down all on temporary restraining orders since the initial ban went in place have been pretty uniformly against various aspects of it. However, at the end of the day, back to what I said originally, the executive has enormous power over immigration. He can, for example, clearly delay the process. We do have the Immigration Act of 1965, I think it is, that basically fundamentally forbids discrimination on the basis of nationality. And that's what's going on here.
And that's what the lawsuits are hanging on, that are starting to sue the Trump administration.
Well,
for
yeah, that's there, but unfortunately, you know, it was a different context at the time. There wasn't any, they were trying to revise the system of issuing visas, and they had under President Johnson, threw open the thing basically to what ultimately became the lottery and allocation of a set number of visas to kind of broadly based upon population. But what has happened, that's the issue, visa issuance and vetting process, where the executive mm-hmm. has enormous impact. However, here, Mr. Trump is dealing with, you know, guys are showing up at the airport with visas, and how do we deal with it? And that's, I think, those people will be protected. There is a troublesome footnote on that in one of the judge's orders. I think it's Judge Brinkema back in Virginia. She ordered that the detainees, the folks kept in the airport in a secure facility, be allowed attorneys, and the Border Protection people refused to do that. So there will be some tensions arising between what does a judge do when the recipient of a lawful court order refuses to obey it. Those tensions might be bubbling up in the weeks ahead.
Yeah. Now, that lawsuit you said that you're working with the organization CARE.
Uh-huh.
Say the name of that again. That's the committee.
Committee for American Islamic Relations.
Yes.
Based out of Washington, D.C.
Okay. Because I was also seeing that there's a group of seven Iranian nationals who have been working with the anti-poverty group Oxfam, and they're asking a Boston judge to extend an order issued on Sunday barring the detention or removal of approved refugees, visa holders, and permanent U.S. residents.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another lawsuit, and that's directly resulting from people who are being detained at an airport, it sounds like, the Boston airport.
Yeah, there's also one down in Los Angeles. I mean, there's probably seven or eight. I haven't been followed each one. They're all what are called TROs, or temporary restraining orders,
mm-hmm.
which are basically, you go to court and you say, I got an emergency problem here, Judge. tell them to stop what they're doing immediately and we'll sort it out later. And the judge will issue a TRO only if he thinks there's a high probability of the person in court, the plaintiff, ultimately winning the case, and that there's an immediate harm that has to be avoided. So it's a high bar, but TROs have been, I won't say they're falling like snowflakes yet, but they've been a number issued. And I don't know of any that's been rejected yet, but there probably are a few.
Okay, well, you know, we're 20 minutes into the show, and I want to give our audience a chance to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. Call and talk about the Muslim ban. So please do call us. I mean that right now. The phones are open, and Tom's here also to answer questions that you may have about this and what's going on with it legally. It's attorney Tom Nelson from here in Portland. In Oregon, actually. He lives up on the mountain, and so we're talking to him by phone. But a longtime attorney on behalf of Muslims who've come into disagreement with law enforcement in this country, and had significant victories in those. If we remember the case of Pete Seda, who the government wanted us to believe was a terrorist down in southern Oregon, and in fact, 5 years later, when the cases all came down to, I think he got one small tax fraud violation for one small entry.
His case was ultimately, it was reverse remanded and indictment dismissed.
All right, so a complete victory. But it took 5 years of his life and a lot of hard work to do it.
2 years in jail.
And so this is your history. This is what Tom Nelson's clientele have been, and I've been really pleased over the years. I also know Brandon Mayfield, the man who many people don't even remember now. It's so long ago, but Brandon Mayfield is a Portland man, an American, who was married to a woman from
Egypt,
and there was a terrorist bombing in Spain. And the FBI wrongly initially and then falsely carried on that it was his fingerprints that were on the bomb, even though he had never traveled there and had no history of being a terrorist. And they did all sorts of new ways that they sneaked into his house when the family was gone, so the family would come home and they could tell someone had been in their house. The government did a lot of things. They locked him up while they were trying to make this case. And I know he first turned to you, and then, of course, it was a criminal case, so it went to a federal criminal attorney,
Steve Wack.
Yes. So that, I think you've played an important role. I also know that you've spoken to city council when you feel that the city is going wrong and encouraging Islamophobia. How are you feeling about the way that about that now here in the Portland area in terms of law enforcement encouraging Islamophobia?
The problem hasn't really been local. The problem has been, in my opinion, the FBI office over the last, since 9/11. They have made a point of doing a lot of show stuff that has basically created more problems than they've solved. Talk now of their various sting operations. The Pete Seda case, for example, a guy has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism, they paint him as one. Well, what they do when they do that is they isolate the Muslim community because they say, look at, if they're doing this to Pete Seda, they can do it to me, and so they're basically chilling any possible relationship and cooperation that they could have, and also they're. You know, for the folks further down the spectrum, somebody's going to stand up and say, you're not going to do that to me or my people, and it's going to get, going to take some action on that. So I think those kinds of actions, all the entrapment and all that stuff that's been going on for since 9/11, has really disserved the Oregon community, the Portland community. On the other hand, the local folks, including representatives in Congress, senators, those folks have been there when we've needed them, dealing with the federal government, dealing with, for example, Jonas Fikre or Jamal Tarhouni. Those folks, the representatives and senators, pitched in and said, "Let's get these people home. Let's start doing the right thing by these people.
You know, that's really good, and it is important to know that we need to distinguish. There isn't one big lump called law enforcement or the government.
Very, very. You know, FBI has been the my major problem for a long, long time. For quite a while, the Portland Police Bureau was not affiliated in any way with the
JTTF or the FBI.
Joint Terrorism Task Force. It is now, but on a somewhat limited basis.
Well, you know, I think we have some callers, so let's have them on the line. Deanna, you're on the air.
Good morning, Linda. Good morning, Tom. Thank you very much for having this conversation. Tom, I have a question regarding sanctuary. My understanding, is that Portland has declared itself a sanctuary city with all that that implies, including non-cooperation of police force with ICE and so forth. And as regards the Muslim ban, anything to do with any threat to any people living in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I understand also that the state has, I think, something called preemptive authority to overrule cities. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I haven't researched that issue, but basically that is generally true, that the cities are essentially creatures of the state, creatures of state statute. And so if the state wanted to, it could pass a statute that could say, for example, that sanctuary cities can't happen in Oregon. I don't think that would happen. As a matter of fact, I understand that it is a state statute, 30 years duration, that basically says Oregon shall not take its residents and turn them over to immigration authorities. It's basically a non-cooperation. It's not that they're going to take steps actively to defend unpapered immigrants. Rather, they are going to say, we're not going to mess with you, even if you are unpapered. We're going to treat you as if you had a right to be here and take care of you as a person, as opposed to somebody who's subject to deportation.
Thank you, but this is also
Oregon. We're among the progressive leaders in the nation. There are many states take probably a pretty strong view to the contrary.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Deanna. I think we have another caller on the line. I want to let other people know the number is 503-231-8187. For any of you who've been out there at the airport or other protests in support of your immigrant brothers and sisters or refugees, I'd love to hear from you. Call in too. So that's 503-231-8187. And now we have Solaris on the line. Welcome, Solaris.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call. I also would like to say I really appreciate the efforts on the state's level as far as police go. I always feel that they have a much better, attitude than some of the other surrounding states regarding Islamophobia and some of the other aspects of police enforcement. My question is pertaining to this somewhat. You mentioned earlier about travel. I read today that they are considering having an IRS possibility, an IRS ban. Could possibly ban you from getting a passport? Is that something that you could comment on? I'm curious about that.
You say IRS, Internal Revenue Service?
Yes, sir.
Well, I hadn't heard that, but I do know that if you haven't paid your taxes in a substantial amount, and I forget what the amount is, $30,000, something like that, they will not issue you a passport until you pay your taxes.
Okay.
That's pretty long-standing. I heard about that about 10 years ago.
Yes, I just saw a news article that was referring to that as a new thing Trump is trying to get involved with.
It's been around a while. As a matter of fact, I had a client who's no longer here who was going for a passport, and they said, nope, pay your child support.
Yeah.
Tom, say that you have paid your taxes in the past, when you got your passport, and so you've had your passport for 10 years, but maybe you decided not to pay your taxes because you hate war, but you still have your passport. What would happen then? What would happen then if you tried to leave the country?
If you tried to leave, they might be able to revoke your passport. However, you, as an American citizen, this goes back to our no-fly stuff, you as an American citizen have an absolute, and let me underline that, absolute right to enter this country and to be in this country because you're an American. So even if they revoke your passport when you're overseas, you're going to get back in because that passport, notwithstanding its revocation, is proof of citizenship. It used to be, and now they say they won't do it, but if you had an old passport and traveled to Canada or Mexico, that old passport would be good enough to get back in the country. And those countries at that time did not require an American passport to enter. And so you could just go down there freely, bring your old, have your old passport in your pocket long since expired, and say, here's who I am. And they say, okay, well, you're an American citizen. That is the sole test for an American to get back in the United States.
Okay.
Are you a citizen?
I guess, also I had a question. I mean, I noticed that they've raised the prices for passports in the past couple of years. Under the Obama administration, it went up almost 60% or something. Really
right.
Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
What is the basic the rights for an American to be able to travel internationally? Is there an international situation? I mean, do we have international rights as a citizen?
You have, according to Judge Anna Brown, one of our local judges, and in accordance with other decisions elsewhere in the United States, you as an American citizen have a constitutional right to international air travel. Okay? That's the no-fly list issue. That right, however, is not absolute. If they're able to show that you're a known, let's say, for example, terrorist or bomb carrier, they're going to say, fine, you're an American citizen, but you're not going to bring that stuff on the plane. But you do have a right to international travel.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. That answered my question. I appreciate you being on with myself. Thank you.
Great questions people are asking. I'm going to tell you that number again. It's 503-231-8187. I'm also going to let you know what's coming up today, February 3rd, here Friday at KBOO. At 9, we're going to have Pacific Underground discussing the effect of immigration order on Asian and Pacific Islander communities, plus a look back on problematic pop culture favorites like Short Round and The Karate Kid. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, it's a Radio Geekly, continues a multi-part series on gatekeeping and the oppression of people of color in geek culture. And I want to thank all KBOO members for your generous support. You know, we're going to be coming up on another membership drive, a fundraising drive, and I want to encourage you to become members if you have not, or give a little extra. In these hard times, all of us independent media and all of the nonprofits with attorneys, they need your support. So we're like the rest of that. We all have to step up a little more. But I want to thank you for the support that you have been giving all of the audience out there. We've gotten tremendous support in the last year, and we appreciate it. I've got another caller on the line. Eric.
Yeah, hello. Good morning.
Good morning, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Enjoy your show. And I have one question. Again, observing Muslim injustice forever. So my question is, why do Muslims take the credit for 9/11? I noticed your host there, or your speaker, mentioned 9/11. So I've noticed that all this injustices to Muslims is because they simply accept the government report. 9/11 has never been scientifically proven. And all the reports have been probably scientifically proven to be false.
Okay, well, I see what you're getting at, Tom. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, we're aware of that, but, you know, frankly, in the popular culture, which is what any community has to respond to, regardless of the truth of the matter, the belief is pretty much universal, with exceptions such as yourself, that it was a 19 Muslim individuals, mostly from Saudi Arabia, Sunni background, who were responsible for 9/11. Once that belief is out in the community, it has to be dealt with, and it has to be countered to the, you know, as best it can be countered. So you have to deal with it. You can't say, wait a minute, it wasn't Muslims, because once the belief is out there, nobody's going to believe you that believe that denial. You have to go forward, even if that fundamental belief is wrong, because you have to deal with the substance of the consequences of that belief.
Yes.
You have to go down the road, and you have to deal with all the bad stuff coming out of that.
I see exactly what you're saying. Well, thank you for that. Do we have another caller on the line now? We've got Jack on the line. Jack, thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm glad you have a legal expert there. I've been making the case with people that the way to deal with this administration, if you disagree with them and feel that they're being unconstitutional, is to sue them. That people should be collecting as much evidence as possible of unconstitutional behavior from the administration, pass that on to attorneys, especially the ACLU, and just sue, baby, sue. Sue them until early and sue them often. And so I'm pleased.
I think I have heard you say that, Jack. I don't oppose.
I've been on the air saying that. And here's the question, though. When it comes to sanctuary cities, okay, the government's threatening to withhold grant money that comes back to the cities. That's our money to begin with. Goes to Washington, comes back to do infrastructure, hospitals, schools, social welfare, whatever. Okay. The fact that it comes from us first, has anybody explored the possibility of the local governments in particular sequestering that withholding tax, redirecting it to escrow accounts, and holding it there until the feds blink?
Well, Jack, that's a very complicated question, but I'm going to let Tom address it, and we do have other callers on the line. Yeah, thank you for calling, Jack.
I'll give a shot at it. Number one, I've never heard of that occurring. Number two, that kind of approach has been attempted before and in other situations, not sanctuary cities, certainly, where somebody says, I'm not going to pay my taxes, but I'm going to put it in my bank account until, for example, you do this you stop doing that. And unfortunately, in all of those cases that I'm aware of, I've never heard of an exception. A federal court pretty quickly says, okay, we'll take the money now, and now you can litigate. And by the way, your litigation chance of winning that is less than zero. So what will happen in the face of that is a federal court, which of course has authority over, number one, the tax administration, and number two, anything a local or state government does ultimately, will probably make short shrift of that argument.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I'm speaking with, just to remind everybody out there, I'm speaking with Tom Nelson, a local attorney, an attorney here in Oregon who has defended many Muslims who have come in, been, harassed and, put on the no-fly list, and many other kinds of circumstances that our government has used against people. And he is a Muslim himself, has married a woman, an American woman, who's a... you said she was from Iran originally?
Yeah, she's an Iranian national who's now an American citizen.
Yeah, and so he has direct personal experience of being a Muslim, being out in public, and how the public responds and the differences that makes. And as we've gone through different stages of, having trials, big trials to make, like that poor young man, Mohammed, be locked up for life when he couldn't have done anything without the FBI helping him. So important cases, and I want to have people talk about not just legal questions they have for Tom, but about what he thinks might happen going forward. And so I'll ask you that, Tom, too, is how do you think you've been giving talks to organizations of Muslims who've been wanting to say, oh boy, what do we do with the land, the lay of the land this way? And so where do you think this ban is going to go? Do you think he's going to get it pushed back? Is it going to be thrown out by a higher court?
I think, okay, let's prioritize this. Number one, the immediate thing is to lessen the risk to Muslims who are traveling or who might be traveling. And you have to deal with that first. The ones that are in detention somewhere, we got to get them out. And ideally get them out into the United States. Beyond that, the next question is, how do we deal with essentially a religious prohibition on immigration? That's a neat question. I think ultimately you can't do that.
Yeah, the attorney general that resigned, Sally Yates, said she does not believe that's a lawful order. We are not allowed to discriminate.
But, you know, that a decision on that, a final decision, is years out. It's at least 2 years out, even if it's not from the Supreme Court. It was a number of circuit courts.
And so you expect that this executive order to be impacting people who are coming to the United States for the next few years?
Oh, it definitely will slow the number of people coming here because, you know, keep in mind that the order was put down in such a manner that it caught people who were already in the air or just entering the airport at the destination somewhere in the United States. Those issues are going to go away because airlines will not allow a person, even with a valid visa, to get on them unless a court orders the airlines to do so. And that's going to be so we're not going to have the immediate problem we have now, excuse me, of folks in detention.
Right.
Trying to get out. Those folks, for the most part, I'd say almost all of them, have been released by court order. They're in the United States and walking around. But the executive authority over immigration, including ultimately visa issuance, is pretty strong. And there's no prohibition whatsoever of how Mr. Trump says it's extreme vetting. Extreme vetting can take not months, years. We've seen that.
Well, and many people are vetted for their visa for years. It takes some years to come.
You know, I know of some personal stories of trying to get a visa by an Iranian coming to the United States. It's very, very difficult. I know a 60-some-year-old woman they wouldn't let in who's, you know, a family member.
Yes.
It's almost inexplicable, but it's just the way things are these days.
Yeah. Well, we've got more callers, so let's go ahead. LJ, thanks for calling.
Hey, Linda, how are you?
Well, I've got a little bit of a frog in my throat, but other than that, I'm doing well.
Okay, ribbit.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you for bringing up the Brandon Mayfield story.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't complete the story. It's my understanding that Brandon Mayfield also sued the FBI, and the FBI did settle with Brandon Mayfield for $1 million.
$2 million.
Am I correct,
Tom?
$2 million.
$2 million, excuse me. So the fact is, people do have recourse, so don't give up hope.
Now, and you're sounding a little bit like Jack, sue often.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that isn't what you have to do. You need to defend your rights.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Mayfield family was harassed and violated by the FBI. And as far as I'm concerned, the Mayfield family were did the right and proper thing by making the FBI accountable. And this is a little personal side note. I was delighted to see the FBI embarrassed and humiliated.
Well, you know, LJ, you're making me think of a question, which is, Tom, when the FBI comes to one of your clients' houses or places of work to talk to your client, or your client finds out the FBI have been visiting places where he's worked, what do you recommend people do when, for example, when the FBI comes knocking, literally knocks on your door and says...
Boy, I'm glad you asked that question because that is...
Well,
that
thank
is
you, Linda. Where, have a good day.
Thank you, LJ. Go
that's
ahead.
That's where things go so terribly wrong because the attitude is, listen, I have nothing to hide and these people have questions, so I'm going to tell them anything they want to ask about, because I have nothing to hide. I'm a good person. That is the most common and tremendously awful mistake that people make when the law enforcement comes knocking. The reason they are there is because to identify a crime and prosecute for it. The person that they are interviewing is essentially a target. And the problem is they are in a real box when that happens because they don't know it, but law enforcement can lie to you with no sanction, no penalty whatsoever in order to get you to talk. And they often do. they can lie about anything, okay?
Yes.
No problem. On the other hand, if you lie to a federal officer about anything, you can be prosecuted for it. And there's some famous cases along this line. Some Judge Jones discussed with Mr. Mayfield in talking about whether he should talk to the federal officials. So the only thing, the best thing to do is say thank you very much. Don't be rude. Don't, you know, these people are just doing their job. They're getting paid for it. They're trained in it. Don't be rude. Don't be angry. Just say, well, thanks for visiting me. No, you can't come in my house. Don't let them in. You know, if it's cold,
yes,
stand on the
don't
porch
let them in. Yeah.
And say, call. I want to call my lawyer. And at that point, and this has happened a number of times, they'll go, well, who's your lawyer? And they'll give them a name. Or if you don't have a name, say, I'm going to get one. In some cases, they then call me, and I will call the FBI agent. They have a card. And I'll say, okay, what do you want to talk about? We can talk about this. What do you want to know? And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, well, we're just kind of looking around. And no, it's really not necessary. No, you don't have to come down. At the end of the day, they have to put up or shut up. And a lot of this is just fishing. I mean, just looking for stuff. You know, you're a Muslim, you're new from here, and you're from Somalia. Okay, well, that's reason enough for a visit. We don't know a thing about it, but we want to know if there is something out there. They're doing their job. But on the other hand, from the individual standpoint, do not talk to them about anything substantive. Tell them who you are. Tell them, yeah, I'm from Somalia, and I got to... Don't talk about your family. Don't talk about where you worship. Don't talk about what you believe. Don't talk about any of that stuff. Call a lawyer. And, you know, the consultation's free. And usually that's all it takes. Do not talk to the FBI.
Well, thank you. I think that's about as straightforward as you can say. What about local police, though? You know, because someone who would come to your door from Portland Police's Intelligence Bureau, if they still have an intelligence wing, would be sharing all of that information with the local FBI at the Fusion Center.
That's the problem with the JTTF. And, you know, the local police really aren't into counterterrorism and all that stuff. They're there for basically to serve and protect, keep people out of trouble. The problem with Portland joining the JTTF is it puts a barrier to contacting the local police, because you say, hey, the mosque is vandalized, and the cops say, okay, we're going to come and investigate. Well, wait a minute. I don't want an FBI guy openly. I'm sure they infiltrate it all the time, but I don't want an FBI guy coming and start snooping around the mosque, not because there's anything to hide, but because he is there for a purpose of prosecution.
Yep.
And you know, you don't want to invite the prosecutor into your house.
So no matter how nice they act or how nice they look or how rough they act, just say, thank you for the visit. May I have your card? I'm going to speak to an attorney.
Yeah, be nice to them. Don't you know, they're people too. I mean, don't dislike them.
Well, it just doesn't do any good either. They just know you lose your temper easily.
It's absolutely the wrong thing to do, to lose your temper.
Well, you know, we have others on calling, so we got to let someone else get in on this conversation. I believe we have another person on the line. It's Conch. Conch, welcome.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello, yeah, so I had a couple of, I've just heard some things back and forth about the legal situation. One is that I heard that in the case of sanctuary cities, the feds cannot withhold funds that are not related to that particular subject, such as if we have a policy of not allowing the INS or ICE to be informed by our police and sheriffs, then the only federal funds that can be withheld are related to immigration, such as Homeland Security and that sort of thing. I wanted to see if that was correct.
I haven't researched that, so I can't. That makes sense, but I can't give you a definitive response on that.
Yeah, and the other question that I sort of come across was, okay, so there are federal judges who have blocked this executive order, and it's really scattershot about which border agents are defying the court order.
Right.
So does it help to take individual names of those border officials who are defying the court order?
Oh, absolutely. And anytime you have any interaction with any law enforcement, get the name. You're entitled to it. Get the name. Who are you, And if it goes beyond that, say, here's who I am. Can I talk to your supervisor? Don't be bashful about that stuff. But again, do it. Say, I would really like to talk to the supervisor because I think he might be off base here. And get the supervisor's name. Get as much information as you can. I've had to chase around for names like that all too often when a simple question would have given me an answer that you need for filing the complaint.
And so when they are defying the judge's stay,
right?
What can people do?
Well, the immediate response, I would think, go to the judge that issued the stay and say, Your Honor, we have a contempt situation here. Supervisor XYZ, who reports to ABC, is refusing to allow attorneys to visit the detainees at the Miami airport. Would you please hail them into court and have them explain themselves and put a sign there? It is clearly a contempt of court.
And so hopefully in some of these situations, Concha, I don't know if you look back at some of these situations, we can find out whether they went ahead and carried that through.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think it would be great to get those names out there.
Pardon me?
I think it would just be interesting to get those names out there.
Let me just put on another hat here, kind of humanitarian hat. I'm a guy that's a peon in the border protection, and I just do what my boss tells me because I got kids and I want to feed them. I don't want my name all over the press because I'm doing what my boss tells me. My boss got to be responsible for it. So nail the people that are ordering,
issuing the order, not the person you're running into. But it's still good to take the name of the person
absolutely.
You're running into,
because that way you can trace who that person's boss is, and you go against the boss.
All right. Well, Conch, anything else there?
No. Thanks. It's very illuminating, and I still would love to hear more about maybe next time around to find out about the sanctuary city and the withholding federal funds.
Yeah.
How specific that has to be.
I can take a quick look at that. We can figure out how to get that resolved.
Yeah, we can get some information about
time.
That in the future. Thank you, Conch. And do we have one more caller on the line? We're just about running out of time. We've got Barry on the line. Barry, thanks for calling.
Oh, yes. Thanks very much, Linda. I noticed somebody called and said, well, why blame the Muslims? They didn't do anything. That's true. This was done. There's a book, Solving 9/11. It's a very literal title, Solving 9/11. And it goes through the entirety of it, how it was down and everything. It was seven people in the Israeli government. And it was
Barry, I don't think we have time to go into the current, the theory about it. But your point being is that you think it was a false flag?
The point being, Christopher Boland, Solving 9/11 by Christopher Boland.
Okay.
It gives a completely new perspective.
Okay. So that's a book, Solving 9/11. Okay. Thanks, Barry, for calling in and getting the name of that book out for people who are interested in that. I know that many people feel that, if we could just prove that this was a false flag event, and by false flag, I mean that it was done by, engineered by some part of our government, not to be able to grab powers, really, to create a chaos and crisis so that they could grab executive power and other kinds of powers. And I'm not going to rule on that one at all. I just wanted to make sure people knew that was what Barry was referring to. I think we're too far along in the process for that to happen. It's like the shooting of Kennedy. It becomes so nobody feels like they can believe anything, even when good research gets done. So, Tom, I want to really thank you for calling, for being available for this show today, Attorney Tom Nelson from here in Oregon. If you had one last thing you wanted to leave people with as we go forward with this situation, because, now it'll quiet down. It'll just be people not making it to this country. How are we going to keep enough energy and attention going to fight this?
Well, really, we should plan for the long term. We should plan. We should think about what kind of country we want to live in, and we can control that. It takes a long-term commitment. It takes a steady commitment. It takes slogging when you don't necessarily want to slog.
we are facing extraordinary threats from this administration on a whole variety of fronts, from dismantling the restrictions on banks. It's today's topic du jour in Washington. We are going to be profoundly challenged in the next 4 years, and we're going to have to, as progressives, as human beings, stand up to that. And it's not going to be glamorous. It's going to require work, dedication, thought, and action.
Yes, well, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. I know that we'll be staying in touch with you, because I don't think Trump intends to let go of his fear-mongering about Muslim people. I think that this is a nice tool for him to keep his base activated around. So we'll need to be talking again in the future as things go forward. Thank you so much for joining me today, Attorney Tom Nelson.
It's been a real pleasure, Linda. Thank you.
You're welcome. And now we're going to go ahead and go on to programming here at KBOO. I want to thank all of the listeners and all of the callers. And now we'll move on to Pacific Underground, I believe.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
On Friday, February 3rd, 2017, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we'll